Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help!
Hello and welcome to Real Recovery. Awfully glad you are with us tonight. George Fraser, Bill Arnold, Ted at the board. We're going to have a great time tonight. We've got a great guest in studio. And, George, we are now in year 8 of Real Recovery, and it's lonely at the top, something we will never experience.
No, totally shocked we're still on.
Yeah.
But going with it, it's been great.
Yeah. And it's been wonderful to meet so many amazing people with incredible stories of recovery.
Absolutely.
What are you laughing at?
I was just laughing at you, actually.
And why?
Joyful that I'm here. You know?
See, you bugged me right away. We don't go 5 minutes and I'm bugged.
Right. Real hard to bug you, too. Real hard to agitate you. It's one of my spiritual gifts.
No,
it's been a great ride. And every week we get to hear stories of dead people that Christ came in and made them alive again. I never get tired of that.
Mm-hmm. And just to get it out of the way, when George was 9, he won the punt, pass, and kick competition in Edina. I know I need to say that like 3 times a year just because it's part of the contract.
Yep.
So get that out of the way now.
Well, you know, I achieved it early.
Yeah, but you're living in the past, pal.
Well, I don't have a future. Come on, I don't have a present.
Yeah.
You know, I'm really good at watching TV.
Yeah. Man, it's hockey season, too, so we're both good at watching TV right now. All right, George, how about a little scripture? Should we get started with that?
Yeah, let's roll that.
3 John, there's only one chapter in 3 John, and it says, starting in verse 2, "Dear friend, I pray that you may enjoy good health and that all may go well with you, even as your soul is getting along well. It gave me great joy when some believers came and testified about your faithfulness to the truth, telling how you continue to walk in it. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children are walking in the truth."
Love that.
Yeah, that's what we're going to talk about tonight.
3 John is right up there with 2 Corinthians for me.
That's right. That's right. If you're from the UK, you might say 2 Corinthians or 3 John. It's pretty standard over there.
Or Washington, D.C.
So Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Yeah. That was great. Billy, we always do a step on this program. And once again, there's nothing magical about the program. The steps came out of the Bible. Where the magic is in Jesus, and those steps point to Christ. So if you're sober and you don't have a relationship with Christ, we want to talk to you about that.
Why not?
Because you're leaving the best part of recovery on the table, like forgiveness of sins, eternal life.
Transformation.
Yep.
Yeah. New strength, restraining power of the Holy Spirit.
Keep going.
You go. I just did 2. You do 1.
Those were the 2 I was going to do.
I don't buy that for a minute.
No.
Yeah.
You're right.
You're copying off my paper right now.
I can't read your computer. Usually I can in the reflection off that window.
Yeah.
But what we want to talk about tonight is step 12, and that's having had a spiritual awakening as the results of these steps. We try to carry the message to other alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. I want to focus on the practicing the principles in all our affairs. Billy, the number one thing I see in the decades, gosh, I'm getting old, I am old, of recovery is people try to quit using. They focus on the problem, and we want to focus on the solution. And scripturally, where that is we can go to 1 Ephesians. Chapter 4. It's
Go ahead and confuse people,
George. Real maturity tonight.
Have at it.
4:22-24, where Paul writes, "You put off the old, but you have to put on the new." And I see many people in recovery, "I'm going to quit using, I'm going to quit drinking, I'm going to quit gambling," and they do everything they can to avoid the behavior. And maybe they're very successful at it. I want to go to John 10:10, where it's written that the thief comes to kill, murder, and destroy, but the Son of Man came to give us life and give it to us abundantly. And I've never met an addict or alcoholic that didn't get addicted because they were looking for abundance in their life. A lot of us, the first time we use it, maybe we'll hear tonight from Dan, I knew something had changed for me the first time I felt that warm feeling. It was like, gosh, this is my solution. This is the deal. But if you just try to stop that and don't fill it, Jesus also said you don't pour new wine into old wineskins or they burst. What we need to do is become, as Bill was saying, we want to get sanctified, be redeemed, and be holy. We put off the old and put on the new to be like Christ. Billy, can you run those verses over there sometime? Ephesians 4:22-24, because I think reading it right out of the word has real impact here.
Ephesians 4 and starting in 22, did you say?
Yeah, it's right around there.
All right. It looks like it starts, you were taught with regard to your former way of life to put off your old self, which is being corrupted by its deceitful desires, to be made new in the attitude of your minds, and to put on the new self, created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. Therefore, each of you must put off falsehood and speak truthfully to your neighbor, for we are all members of one body.
Doesn't that speak recovery to you?
Totally.
I'm putting off the old, I'm putting on the new. And one of the great things, if you're out there going, this is very challenging, the creator of the universe not only wants you sober, but once you get sober and saved, he's got a job for you to do. Carry the message. And that is step 12 from there. We carry the message to the people that are hurting because we have an in. What God has done for us, we can share with other people because we have walked the walk. I don't go to a golf pro that doesn't play. You know, I want to go. I know what you're thinking. I should just quit altogether.
You never started with that illustration.
Yeah, but I want to have somebody that has something to share because they've walked the walk with me. And every Christian is in recovery, so I don't want to say that you have to be a recovering alcoholic to work with alcoholics. It does help. But if you're a Christian, you're in recovery. How is your life changed by being a Christian? That's what you can share with people that are still struggling.
Mm-hmm. And I think people in recovery, George, and you'll need to say yes or no to this, are constantly doing cost-benefit analysis with everything that comes into their world. So when you talk about Jesus and receiving Jesus, you know, you can also hear the term, you know, accept Jesus, but that almost sounds like you're going to look at the pros and cons and then decide if he's acceptable. The truth is, what Christ gives is the gift of salvation, which is something you believe in and receive.
Right.
So when you think of the way people in recovery will often look at and do cost-benefit analysis, what do I get from this? What is this going to cost me? Is this worth the risk, or am I going to end up, you know, just being back to where I started, or even worse? And I think you have to understand when Christ comes and says, I want to transform, redeem your life, and make it new, you're doing nothing but receiving by faith the gift of salvation.
Right. And then you have to act on it. And I think a lot of the things we grew up in the 70s and 80s were, I think in Christianity, they were trying to get a lot of people to become accounts by accepting Jesus as their Savior. I mean, after all, he died for you. You know, you kind of owe him that. But what we want to talk about and build on, Bill, is really changing your life. If I say I accept Jesus and my life hasn't changed, I want to look at that. Fair?
Absolutely, yeah.
That
yeah.
You always talk about everyone votes for Jesus, but do you really want to make him Lord over your life? And that's where we have the problem.
Yeah, except the atheists. They don't vote for Jesus. They're
right.
Mad.
Well, you can't be 100%.
No, I know. But, I mean, they're oftentimes just mad. They're mad at God. They're mad that they're, you know, is a God they don't understand or a God that has not done something about their circumstances. And they say that they're an atheist, but I don't believe that they truly believe there is no God.
I totally agree with that. How can you have a belief system based on nothing?
Right.
My whole belief system is that I'm against that.
Yeah, I'm angry about this God that doesn't exist.
Right.
Yeah, so that doesn't work either. So let's take a little break, George, as we are on this roll. And maybe when we return, we'll bring on our guest Dan in studio, who's waiting patiently, unless we get back on a roll, and then there's no time for him. What do you think?
In the band.
I know it. What is it?
You know Barb O'Reilly from high school. It's the who off, who's next.
Yeah, there we go. That's George Fraser and his wisdom.
Ancient wisdom.
Ancient wisdom. We'll take a break and we'll be back with more Real Recovery in just a minute. All right, George, this could be a good night. Like every night, Road Recovery is. Every night's good. That's it. That's all you got.
Oh, you were waiting for a response?
Yeah, some small
response. I'm not going to argue with that. I think it is great.
No, I agree.
And we never know what God's going to do with the program because he speaks through people who show up, right?
Yes, and thanks to all of our listeners. And thank you for when you listen to the program and like it, and then you tell someone else to listen, and then they listen because there's so many people that are looking for answers, and they're struggling with addictions, and they are not knowing where to turn. And this is a... That's a great place to hear the gospel, and because only the gospel will transform your life.
Amen to that.
Yeah, yeah.
We can short-circuit our recovery and miss the whole point because we think it's about us. And you hear people, I was one of them for the first 25 years I was sober. I'm a great guy because I'm not harming myself or other people anymore. They should throw a parade for me. How did you do it, George? I didn't do it. God did it.
Yeah.
And if you read the promises, you will see that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves, what we didn't want to do. And get honest with that. God has brought you this far. Give him the credit and follow him. He's got many more blessings for you.
Yeah. Now, George, you know Real Recovery is the show where we want to serve people. We want to have the Lord lead us every show we do. And so I'm sitting there having coffee with our friend, Bob Solheim, right?
Oh, I love Bob.
Bob's world's
nicest
guy.
I'm going to be a renter in the future.
Yes, you are.
Yeah.
Yes, you are. And a gentleman approaches me and said, hey, I recognize your laugh. Huh, that's interesting. And it was our guest in studio, Dan. He said, I recognized your laugh. And he came over and said, are you Bill Arnold? And I said, yeah. So that's how we met.
Wow.
Yeah. And he's here in studio, and he's going to tell his story. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. See, he's already got a great voice, and you and I are already feeling a little intimidated.
Yeah. I've accepted the fact I don't have a lot of talent, but that's cool that you would walk up to it. That's a godly appointment.
I think so. There's nothing in God's economy is inconsequential. So anyway, you have been listening to Faith Radio. You're a fan of the program, and you've listened to Real Recovery, and you're a good candidate to be on the show.
I guess so. I went up to you to say hi. I was not expecting to be booked. So
that's
thank
true.
You for that surprise.
That's true. But I think I had been praying for new guest possibilities. So then when you came up and said hi and said that you do have a story of recovery, I wanted to hear it. So that's funny how that works.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's very cool.
Yeah,
very cool.
It's fun.
So you grew up in the western suburbs here in Minneapolis/St. Paul.
I did. Yeah.
And what was your upbringing like?
Let's see. It was good. It was good. I had a grew up in a very loving family. Very loving single mom, raised by a single mom. Didn't meet my dad. I knew who my dad was, but I didn't meet him until I was 19. That's a whole other story. Maybe we'll get to it. But yeah, the upbringing was I was the only child with my mom, and from the time I was born, it was just my mom and myself. But then all of my aunts and uncles and my grandma and grandpa. So we all lived, I grew up and we all lived together in the same home. So I was an only child, but I was surrounded by a lot of people. And so, my grandpa, who was kind of my father figure, was hard worker. And, I was grew up well. And like I said, I always like to say to break the stereotypes of recovery that, once I get into my recovery story, there's a lot of people that assume I must have grew up in a very dysfunctional household, and I didn't. It was, sin does not discriminate, and so I was very much in a really good, loving environment, and then strayed later in life. So yeah, it was a great upbringing, and so I can't blame any of the things that I chose to do later in life on, growing up in that kind of environment. Later on, I found out once I did meet my dad, I found out that there's a lot of similarities with him. He's in recovery now as well. I think he sobered up in the mid 80s. And so when I sobered up later in life, my dad and I had something to relate with. And I realized I was a lot like him.
Wow.
He wasn't in my life.
Even though you'd never known him.
Right.
Interesting. So it's fascinating to me that although you didn't have siblings, you had kind of an interesting conglomerate of loving folks, aunts, uncles, grandpa, all in the house. So you've got mentors, you've got people that are looking out for you as adults, which kind of a, I don't hear that story. I don't think I've heard that story ever. Single child with all these adults.
Mm-hmm. And I was not spoiled because of that.
You were not spoiled.
Everyone always, oh, you're a spoiled little single, you know, only child. Nope,
yeah.
Not.
Yeah.
I was not spoiled.
So I would imagine, Dan, that you, if you're, you know, only child, that you kind of have this feeling that you don't want to create any trouble for your mom. Is that fair?
That is fair. Yeah. My, you know, I would have, my beef with my mom, I guess, was that she was, I felt overprotective of the time. So my other kids, my other friends were out running around and staying out late and,
yeah.
You know, I had curfews and stuff. And, I look back and I'm grateful for that. But yeah, so I was very, if my mom hears this, I hope she agrees. I think I was very respectful of my mom. Mm-hmm. I really appreciated her and my grandma too. My grandma, you know, my mom's working. And so my grandma was home. And so, she did a lot of the work with me, you could say. She raised me a lot of the time as well. And again, she was awesome too. So yeah, I did not want to ruffle feathers
okay.
with my mom until later. You know, later
yeah.
I did. But.
So when did little bit of the rebellion set in?
I would say junior high.
Junior
so,
high?
So, yeah.
Is that the same for you, George, junior high?
Ninth grade.
Okay.
You know, late ninth grade, 10th grade.
That's not about right.
Yeah, it was. I would say seventh grade. Seventh grade was when I started hanging out with the wrong crowd
mm-hmm.
and started really. Because the one thing that, you know, and I would have never known this when it was happening, but the situation later in my life, looking back, I realized how insecure I was as a kid. I mean, that all came out. You know, and a lot of that fueled what I ended up doing and the reasons that I was, you know, just the wind blew and I would hang in with a different crowd of people because I wanted to fit in. But so it's very influenced, easily influenced by people. So in seventh grade, I started hanging out with at the time I grew up in the 80s. And so, you know, we were skater punks. And so I hung out with the skater punks, the skateboarders.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So automatically, you know, call it stereotypical or whatever, but we got into trouble, you know, and at that time, the trouble was jumping fences and skating in, you know, empty swimming pools and just, you know, vandalism and just punk stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, goofy stuff. And still, I wasn't, had no desire for drinking, for drugs, because I wasn't really hanging out with people who were doing that. We were just listening to, you know, punk music and getting into some mischief. That was
okay.
kind of the thing through junior high.
So the thing is, you're hanging out with guys you think are cool.
Yeah.
And, you know, not following the rules is kind of cool. There's nothing real destructive, but you guys are cool. You're on the edge. You got an identity, and you got some guys to hang with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Nothing wrong with that. The need for that, we all do it, but then it kind of starts going downhill a little later. How old were you when you started experimenting? Did you smoke pot or cigarettes first?
Cigarettes. Cigarettes came when I was, it was my first, loosely say, girlfriend, the first guy I was interested in. And she smoked, and it was cool. And so I started smoking.
Did you smoke hers? I mean, those couldn't have been Marlboro Reds.
Oh,
right?
were they lucky? Camel Straights.
Oh, Camel.
Camel Straights.
Okay, he's a
yeah.
real man.
Yeah.
I was just a pretend. I was the cowboy guy.
Yeah, I was.
He died of lung cancer.
Yeah. But yeah, so I started smoking and hanging out with, you know, so I immediately started kind of shifting to hang out with kids who smoke now. So we had, well, that was a little bit in high school, but so that was probably eighth grade, maybe I started, I think that's when I started smoking, and that came before anything else.
How long till you were smoking pot and maybe drinking a little?
A while. The drinking, I picked up my first drink. So it was cigarettes, and then I picked up my first drink senior in high school, actually.
Okay.
So it was a while after that, and I was never interested in – I was actually scared. Like, I'd – you know, the commercials or whatever on TV actually, and probably my mom, scared me about drugs. And so I was like, well, I'm never going to do drugs. I'll smoke, and then eventually I'll drink. So
– okay. But they didn't have those good commercials like that. They had Reefer Madness. Do you ever see that movie?
I did.
So were your grades good? Were you a pretty good kid outside of the cigarettes?
Good kid, yeah. Not good student. I was always a bad student.
Okay. No church either, right?
No, so not for me. So I went to church with some of my family up until I was like 8 years old. And it was, I was always kicking and fussing about going. And then finally my grandpa, who oftentimes I go to church with, just finally said, do you even want to go to church? And I said, no, not if I had the choice. And so they said, fine. And so I remember that. I remember that being kind of like my first big boy decision, I guess, when I was 8, going, yeah. Oh, that was easy. I'm just going to watch cartoons and sit home.
Well, if they had infant baptism at that church you're covered, so you could make that call. That's interesting, because I'm looking forward to how that comes back around. So you're in high school. You start drinking your senior year. I think a lot of people did that. I know one person who didn't, but a lot of people did. And what are you going to do after high school?
So I have a pretty typical story of the drinking bit that was, you know, I think I'd been seeking, I wanted to be, you know, now as a Christian, having Christ in my life, I wanted to be known, right? And I think that's why I was going after whoever would give me time and whoever I felt comfortable with. And I was just giving pieces of myself to these groups of people that would hang out with me, because I really wanted to be known. And not that I wasn't, you know, I look back at my like I said, my upbringing, and it's not like I didn't get attention from my mom. You know, I did. But and I think now looking back, it was that father wound that was developing of not having a dad around. And there's, you know, my mom is awesome, like I said, but there's just something about that, the voice of the dad, you know, speaking into your life. And so I think I don't know. I think that had played into it a little bit, is this, I was just seeking. And so when I found this habit, like cigarette smoking, who else is doing that? Right. And then I was accepted into that group, and we'd all skip class and go to Burger King when you used to be able to smoke at Burger King and sit in the smoking section, and because they never carded you, they didn't care. So we'd just, you know, walk from junior high or whatever and go do that, or sit at Perkins. And so that kind of morphed. And then so I really, especially once I started drinking in my senior year in high school, it was actually in spring break. Me and a couple guys did, looking back, it was the worst planned spring break you could ever imagine. It was, you know, let's go get a couple bottles of whiskey, and the three of us jumped in a car and went to Fargo. I don't know why we went to Fargo. And then we just drove, you know, we drove and did a little road trip, and just, you know, and we didn't even bring enough booze. It was really poorly planned. And so we drank it up pretty quick. But I remember that feeling hanging out with these other two guys, and I drank, you know, I think it was Canadian Windsor is what we drank. And I actually have a picture someplace in a shoebox of the before and the after. So I was cheering, you know, the styrofoam hotel cup with the whiskey or the whatever it was, and took the slam. And then there was a picture of my face just cringed up, like, oh my gosh. But that feeling of like, oh, especially when I got that buzz going, and it was like, I just found something, and I really like this.
All right, we're going to need to take a little break. You're listening to Real Recovery. We're going to take a short 90 seconds and be right back. You're listening to Real Recovery. Bill Arnold and George Fraser. George Fraser has the intelligence of a man half his age, which is, I think, so impressive.
I don't have the memory of a man half my age, though. So.
We're enjoying the testimony and story of Dan in studio, and it sounds so far, George, like these are pretty basic things that a guy looks for. If you don't have a father in your life, you're trying to form your own identity. You've never had a man to bump up against and be taught the ways of manhood and all that. So you find your identity with cool people or people you think are cool. You know, I think of when Jesus was baptized and he comes out of the waters of baptism and the heavens part, and a dove descends and the voice of God says, "This is my son whom I love, with whom I'm well pleased." You know, basically, you're mine. I love you. I'm proud of you. You go out into the world with that confidence, you're going to do just fine. But if you never get that in life, you might spend a big portion of your life trying to find it.
Well, and you can have a dad not get that. You know,
I agree.
I know a lot of dads of the generation I was raised that never said how proud they were because you could always be better than the other guy, Bill. But not that we haven't worked through this a long time ago, because we
that
have.
That sounds pretty raw and fresh,
but,
if you ask me.
You know, it sounds to me like he's a pretty normal kid. And we're going to have these needs met. You know, where do they go? So now we go on the fateful road trip, Fargo.
Yeah, the Fargo trip to Fargo.
I would change that part of the story, but we're an honesty program here. So what happened after Fargo? That's a changer for you, or you wouldn't have brought it up.
Yeah. After we made it back, bummed out that we didn't get enough booze for the trip, but because I think we were gone for like, I don't know, a week, gone for like a week or something like that. And so we came back. And it was, now I was making plans, you know, now I had this new bad lease on life, to put that phrase in kind of reverse and negative. And so I came back and, the guys that I went on this trip with, we came back and said, you know what, let's get an apartment. Cause I was living with my mom. Obviously I was a senior in high school. You know, had no aspirations for college, none at all. So I had no plans. I mean, so I didn't disrupt any plans of going anyplace because I really didn't have any, you know, any aspirations or motivations at all. I was at this point, and so a couple things happened. So I got back from this trip, and then so when I got back, I think the first conversation we had was let's get an apartment. You know, let's do this full time kind of thing. And so I think I don't remember the details, but I think we found a place and. Near where, you know, where I was growing up in Plymouth, that was cheap, affordable and whatever. And so we made plans to do that. And at the same, and then the other part of what I was doing, is I went down and I talked to whoever the person in high school to find out what credits I had. And literally I found out, okay, I have, I don't know how many credits over. So I just literally said, what do I need to graduate? Great. I'm going to cut the rest out. And I just skipped those classes. And then literally I went to school for the minimum amount I needed to. And then other than that, we were out doing our thing and I jumped right in and now I know that I was a binge drinker. Immediately just the attention that I was able to get. So once we got back and then I started going to parties, right? So then there was plenty of alcohol. And right away, I developed this reputation of just being a really heavy drinker. And cause I even just right off the bat, it was, I would joke and just say, this is what I'm built for because I could just drink and drink and drink. And I was a beer guy. I was a beer guy until I blacked out and then I was a whatever guy. And so that's when I would drink fast, you know, go get a case of whatever was on sale and then drink, get into a blackout and then, there might be people who come with drugs. I don't even know. I honestly have no idea what I did. I know there were some times that I woke up and I was like, there was something more than alcohol last night. But that was part of the rush of I kind of developed a quick pattern and that's what I did. And that's all I really cared about. And so, and it was heartbreaking because my mom didn't know that part. She didn't know what was going on with the drinking. But which I knew that's why I wanted to get out of the house so I could do my thing and not, you know, not hurt my mom.
No curfews in the apartment.
Right. Exactly. And so I remember, and I don't even think I told her what I was doing in school. That would make sense that I wouldn't tell her that, cause she wouldn't have approved of it. And so we got this apartment and I remember going to my mom and saying, you know, I'm moving out with these two guys. And she was not happy. We got in, and if I remember right, a pretty heated article or argument about it. And so she made it very clear that I was making a big mistake, and I didn't care. At this point, it was 110% about me, and that was the first time I remember enough about that exchange to know she was the first person that I really hurt, and I didn't care. And so, and that for me, part of my story was. That was out of character for me. I was a pretty caring kid, you know, especially for my mom. And so that was the first time that I was just like, you're in my way and I'm out. See ya.
How quickly, and you said you're a binge user, and by that criteria, how quickly do you think you were an alcoholic?
I don't 100% know where I stand on the whole, like, you're born an alcoholic versus this or that. I know now what I know about my dad and many of my uncles. And probably some of my aunts, but I know there's alcoholism that was there. And so, but especially with my dad, I mean, we were cut from the same cloth.
So there's a genetic predisposition but very quickly you're drinking for effect, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah.
And you're drinking to total blackout.
Right.
And that's quick, right?
Yeah. Yeah, wow. It was, yeah, within a, you know, few hours. That was kind of, and again, that was my thing. You know, I quickly developed this reputation or whatever that was just funny.
Mr. Blackout. Yeah.
Yeah. And I had a guy, if he hears this, his name is Eric, and he was my roommate for a long time during those times. And he was kind of my guy the next day, because he actually didn't really drink at all. But he would hang out with us. But I just remember the next day I would wake up and I never once threw up. I never got sick from alcohol, and I never, maybe I probably had hangovers and I probably took a beer the next day to get rid of that, take the edge off. But I remember I'd wake up and my buddy Eric, I'd be like, what did I do last night? And he would give me an update. Well, see that end table? It's broken because you fell on it. Or see this? Or, you know, where did I park my car? You know, I'm ashamed to say that I praise God that nobody got hurt, because I would wander off by myself and grab my car to go get a pack of smokes or just stupid stuff. Again, out of character, just didn't think.
How long did you drink until you started to get legal consequences or to where for you it just wasn't working?
Yeah. And I, you know, if I call it my drinking career, it really wasn't that long, but I hit it hard. And so I was 18, I think, when I started drinking, senior in high school, towards the end of, you know, spring break, towards the end of it. And 18, it was a year when I was 19, December 21st, maybe, right before Christmas. When I was 19, I got my first DWI, and that was, you know, pretty, blood alcohol was, 0.27, it was very high. And
was that higher than your grade point average in high school?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah, quite a bit.
Yeah, I can relate. I had this too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's and now I even remember when I got sober and I would go to AA and I would tell these stories, like I'd still be bragging about it, like I 0.27, guys, check that out, you know. And now I'm, man, it's. It's a sad situation.
It goes, I think God really helps us in that it goes, the funny stories, because of God's intervention, become sad and not funny anymore. And at the time, gosh, they're great war stories. And let me tell you what Dan did, and we all laugh. And then after a while, you realize, that's not funny at all, right?
Right.
But at the time,
yeah,
it fits right into Mr. Blackout, 2-7.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So did you have to go to treatment because of your DWI?
No.
Better lawyer than I had. But go ahead.
So that would have been in 90, what would that have been, 94 maybe, that I got that one? And the rules were pretty soft in 90, in the early 90s on DWIs. And so, no, I got my first one. I was obviously way over the legal limit. I'm surprised I didn't get worse because of the scenario, because I was in a total blackout. It was in the winter, it was in December, and I spun out my car. I had a guy with me, and we were trying to push my car out. Again, this is all, I read this, or I heard it, you know, secondhand, because I don't remember it. And while I was stuck, it was making a lot of noise. Somebody called the cops. The cops got there, and apparently I ran, drove. It was a little car chase or whatever, and they got me. And so literally it wasn't until the next day that I was told what I did by the sheriff.
Ouch.
Yeah. And I was like, nah, I didn't know. And they're like, no, this is what happened. And this is where we found you. And, you know, you evaded us and whatever. So it could have been a lot worse as far as charges.
Did that scare you enough to quit drinking?
No. Okay. At the time it was.
No need to overreact, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, you called it a war story. That's what it was. It was about my time, because all my other buddies had these cool stories of getting arrested and, you know, and now I had mine.
So did that moderate your behavior at all?
No. Okay. If anything, it might have. It either didn't do anything or it pushed me farther into, all right, now I'm all in.
So you're careful about driving.
Yeah. So I think what had happened is I lost my license for 6 months. And that was about it. I mean, I did it. So they didn't send me to treatment or anything. They didn't I don't think they did an assessment. I had nothing that came back that said I have a problem. It's just I went to the judge and they said, slap your hand and don't do that. And, you know,
did you drive
probation
without your license?
I'm guessing I did.
Yeah,
I don't,
you drive like
sure
grandma when you don't have your license. You know? So what was the next consequence?
So the next one, I would say the next legal one was 2 years later, almost to the day, with my second DWI. That was literally Christmas night into the next morning that happened. There was other moral consequences in there. There's things that, you know, again, I just was going. And at this point, after what did happen after that first DWI, is especially facing my mom and saying, you know, because I think she had, I don't think she picked me up. I don't remember what was going on, but that was hard to see the disappointment in my mom's face.
Yep.
And so it hit me. I mean, I set it aside because this is just who I am and I'm just going to keep doing. But I think that was where it was starting to wear away at me inside of knowing this is not who I am, I think. But yet again, I was trying to fight that because this is who I felt my identity pointed me to. This is the guy that my friends want me to be. And this is, you know, whatever. So through that, the immoral relationships and the friendships, this is where I really started to wear my relationships down. And I started to just push people out of my way that were not doing what I was doing. The selfishness kicked in full blast. And it was just, I was on this mission. Although it might've been a mission going straight down, I was on a mission and people were in my way. And so now I was really hanging out with people that were ultimately kind of as bad as me or doing the same things that I was doing. And it was just getting harder and harder.
All right. We're gonna take a little break. When we come back, lots more with Dan. You're listening to Real Recovery, and we are glad you are doing that. We'll take a 90-second break and be right back. Dan is telling an amazing story. I'm awfully glad he's in studio with us tonight. Bill and George, you listen to Real Recovery. And thank you for listening and supporting Faith Radio. If you missed any of this, you're going to want to hit rewind, go back to the beginning. And you can do that right on the website at myfaithradio.com. All right, Dan, you've had lots of opportunities to rebel and to continue your using. And now what's going on in your head spiritually, and how did God break into your life and say, I want you to start looking at me instead of yourself?
Yeah, that's a great question. So that second DWI is kind of what really got my attention. The scenario around that was bad. I ran into a building with my car, and that just the situation was one of, like, I could not look back and go, that could have been a lot worse. Again, I was at that point, I really high blood alcohol on that one as well. Blackout, didn't, you know, I learned all this stuff. This stuff I learned when I went to court. So when they read the police report or whatever to me. And so that was really, and again, I had to face my mom. So I, you know, got to see this disappointment and just feel it. And like, oh, and at this point, prior to that, what was leading up to that second DWI is I was in this really, really dark place. Again, like I mentioned, from the time I was eight, that's when I sort of invited God out completely of my life. Mm-hmm. And never brought him back in. I went deeper and deeper into, you know, I got into, even in my teenage years, just really weird, dark type religious stuff. I got into all these crazy things. And so, but then I think when this happened, I would have called myself an atheist, not realizing that atheism was kind of a religion. So I was probably just an agnostic, but I was very angry at God. And so I had nothing in me. So I was so for me, when that second DWI hit, prior to that, I had, you know, thoughts of suicide and thoughts of just like, dude, I'm just miserable, you know? And at this point, the solution, the drinking that I was finding my identity in, had now officially become the problem. I mean, it did earlier, but it wasn't working anymore. And so I was trying to mask it, and I was going deeper and deeper into this hole. So the second DWI in one aspect kind of saved me, because this time I went before the court, before the judge. I had to go to treatment. I was mandatory, required to go to AA, and that happened, right? And
where did she go to treatment?
It was actually, they did an assessment, and I think the assessment said that I wasn't that bad of an alcoholic or
so
something.
You lied on your assessment.
I think I did.
I think I did. I like that. You're not under oath. Let me rephrase the question. Sounds like you might have minimized on your assessment.
Okay. You bet.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you go to treatment. Or you didn't go to treatment.
I went to an outpatient. It was like an evening outpatient. It was called, it was great. It was called ARC. I was in Plymouth. I don't know if it's still there. If it was, you guys are awesome. But when I knew I had to go into this thing, this is what I appreciated about this treatment center, is I went into it thinking, okay, I have to go to this, and it's going to be a bunch of clinical people with, you know, that think they know about me because they went to school for it and whatever. And I went there, and it was run by drunks. And they were young drunks. Like, I was 22, I think, when I sobered up, 22 or 23. And so I was a young guy with a chip on my shoulder. And so I thought it was going to be a bunch of old guys, you know, sitting around smoking cigarettes, you know, like the whole stereotypical AA thing. And it wasn't. It was these young guys. They were probably just maybe a few years older than me. And they spoke my language. They spoke about my pain. And I finally heard them in those sessions. And I don't remember how many I had to go to. But they got my attention because I'd realized for the first time ever that I wasn't alone in this. And they were telling me my story, and I'm going, yes, I think that's why I drank. I think that's why I was running and running and running, and I couldn't escape what I was running from, because wherever you go, there you are. And so I was just like in this place where I was listening. I finally just shut my mouth, opened my ears, and I listened to these people in the group, and the other people too that were required to be there, whatever, heard some really good stories that motivated me to go, maybe I'm doing it wrong. And maybe I do actually want a chance. And I, you know, and at this point I was probably actually sober for, I don't know, a week, couple weeks or something like that. And so I had some clarity.
Mm-hmm.
And then they said I had to go to AA, but I'm pretty sure that I connected with somebody and we went to AA, somebody that I trusted with from the group, I think. And I'm pretty sure we went to an AA group together. So again, I didn't know what to expect. I thought it was the old guys and all that stuff. And again, I went to this meeting called Keep It Simple in Wayzata, I think was the first meeting I went to. And it was young people, probably 50, 60 young people, I think. At the time, it was really big. And some guys younger than me. And it was amazing to see other people smiling, like real authentic. They had joy, and I didn't know what that was. And I went, and I just listened. And I don't know if I shared in the first few groups I was in, because I think that was a step study meeting, and we'd break up. But it was the first time that I started to listen, and I realized, okay, all right, I'm gonna hear these guys out. So that was kind of the point where I really got my attention. Still, and then I started to give this whole higher power thing a shot. Because I went in there, that was my biggest issue of, you know, okay, this, I'm doing this on my own, and I'll put up with the stuff that I hear, but I got a sponsor. That was a big thing. I got a sponsor. I don't know if he's a Christian. I don't think he was, but he prayed, and he gave me the little wallet card with the Lord's Prayer and the St. Francis Prayer, and I remember I took those things, and I just started praying. Because he would say every morning, thank God. And when you lay your head down at night and you're sober, thank God for a sober day. And I would do that. And I was really under the impression that, you know, for me to drink is to die. Because at this point, I'd built up just enough rewards, and I'm doing air quotes, of sobriety that I liked what was happening. And I liked the feeling that I had that I wasn't hurting people anymore. And I think at this point, I was having dinner with my mom and hanging out with my mom, and it wasn't, you know, this tension, and there's just some good things happening, and I wanted to keep that going.
I love it. When did you finally get to church?
So I was 3 years sober, doing probably 3 to 5 AA meetings a week, chair in meetings, and I learned this whole idea of service, and I loved it. I loved giving back. And after 3 years and, you know, sobering guys and sponsoring guys and it was just, I wanted to help. After 3 years of doing all of this really great stuff, but now looking back for the wrong reasons, it was because I wanted to stay sober. It was still about me. And after 3 years, I started really just getting dry again. I was just, why am I doing it? It was getting harder to go to meetings. And there was nothing bad happening. There wasn't, I don't think I was close to a relapse. It was me just going, is this it? Like, is this, I see guys in the meeting that are there for 20 years and some of them don't look happy.
Right.
You know, and okay. So, so I really started to ask myself these questions. And I had, at work, I had a couple Christians that we were able to talk prayer, because I could talk prayer with people. The minute they brought up Jesus, I would shut them down and say, no, you just can't know. And so God was using people and using these circumstances of serving and serving, but for what? To bring me to a point where I actually saw a flyer for this church in Uptown that met on a Saturday night. And I was waiting. I was going to go to the big Basilica Saturday Night Live AA meeting. And I looked at, I saw this flyer, and then I looked at the time, and I was like, oh, I can go to this church. The church tagline was, do you want God, not religion? Warning, this is not your parents' church. And I was like, that's a church? That sounds awesome. And so I went there, and it was this non-denominational, really young church, Christian church. And I went there and heard the gospel.
Hmm.
And that was, and I think I skipped out early and still went to the Saturday Night Live meeting. But I was like, what was up with that church? And it was great.
Yeah. Now you got your Bible open, and I'm curious as to what verse you've got that you want to read.
Yeah. So this is so I went. I heard the gospel, the simple gospel presentation, and I didn't. You know, I think I had a hard time because it seemed too simple. It was literally, if you think, you know, if you leave tonight, you die. How sure are you going to go to heaven? You know, and then you can be 100% sure, and they walked through the scriptures and a lot of the stuff, and I thought about that. I went home and I prayed to accept Christ, and then they gave me a Bible at that church, and I remember I dug, for whatever reason, I don't know if it was a suggestion or if this is the Lord, but I went right to Romans, and I started reading Romans and reading what Paul was writing, especially in like Romans 7. I was like, man, he gets me. Yes, I want to do what I want to do, what's right, but I can't always do what's wrong, and it was like this internal struggle with this other man in me, in my baby Christian mentality of being a new creation but not understanding it, that was a big thing. But the verse that was huge, I don't know, my cheaters, I'll try to read this. But this is in Romans 6, and it says, this is verse 12, do not let sin control the way you live. Do not give in to sinful desires. Do not let any part of your body become an instrument of evil to serve sin, which was my life. Instead, give yourself completely to God, for you were dead, but now you have new life. And it goes on and on, and it's just, and so that whole, and that was when I realized I was dead. I was a walking dead man, and that really got my attention.
Wow, George, it's been a powerful testimony. Dan, it's been just a delight hearing your story, and it's just been fantastic that God has, again, George, you say a dead man has become alive, and now with 20-plus years of sobriety, he's walking the walk and talking the talk. It's been great having you in the show.
Yeah, that question, if you died tonight, where would you spend eternity, got me too.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you so much for listening to Real Recovery. We're just so glad you have joined us tonight. Please tell your friends about us and pass this episode on. It will be a blessing to others. You can go to myfaithradio.com and then go to the Real Recovery page. You can see the picture of George and I, which was taken years ago, which we have not updated for obvious reasons.
Look at Bill's orange shirt.
Would you knock it off with the orange shirt? I like the orange shirt. I'm going to wear that next time.
It's like a Star Trek deal.
I don't care what it looks like to you. Anyway, thanks for listening, and have a great, great night, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.